I'm Jason Solomons, and you're listening to Film Weekly. Yes, the heat in the studio is rising as we host two of the most dynamic and brilliant British character actors in the business. Ian Hart, the actor's actor, will be joining me to discuss his role in A Boy Called Dad, a coming-of-age story in Extremis. And from kids to kidnapping, Eddie Marson stars in the British thriller The Disappearance of Alice Creed as a simple ransom demand unravels. Peter Bradshaw joins me to review some of the week's other releases, including Robert Downey Jr. is the man in a can in Iron Man 2, and Austrian bank job thriller Revanche. Should that be a Gesundheist? Oh yes, it's a real test of character. It's Film Weekly. Now established as one of our finest character actors, Ian Hart first came to wide attention for his still highly regarded portrayal of the young John Lennon in the 1994 Beatles picture Backbeat. That performance as the first Nowhere Boy consolidated the actor's ability to bring a nervous, almost violent energy to the screen, and it's this edgy blend of humour, anger and tenderness that has powered his best subsequent performances, from Ken Loach's Land and Freedom, Stephen Frears' Liam, and even his performance as the malign Professor Quirrell in that first Harry Potter film. Other memorable faces of Ian Hart include Nobby Stiles in Best and Brian Keenan in Blind Flight. And don't forget Dan in Michael Winterbottom's Wonderland. This week, Hart plays a much softer, if still dysfunctional, character called Joe in A Boy Called Dad, father to the wayward Robbie, played by newcomer Kyle Ward, who at 14 has a difficult relationship with his own dad and has just become a dad himself.
Why do you sound like a monk?
Lived in Manchester with our Katie's dad.
Got a sister?
Pain in the arse.
So how come you hear them?
Me and Terry split up.
How old are you now, mate?
14. How come you never came to see us?
Yeah, I would if I could, but, you know, it's complex, you know what I mean, with Ireland and that.
How long are you here for now?
Not long.
Ian Hart as Joe and Kyle Ward as his son Robbie, trying to reconnect there. So to tell me more about A Boy Called Dad, I'm delighted to be joined in our studio by Ian Hart. Welcome to Film Weekly, Ian.
Thank you very much.
Lovely to see you. Congratulations on your performance in A Boy Called Dad. They say never work with kids, but this one seemed to bring a very good side of your performance out. It was a very loving and tender, the scenes that you had with Kyle Ward.
Yeah, I still maintain never work with kids, though.
Because they might be better than you.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than being outshone by a 12-year-old. No, Kyle was great to work with. I mean, Kyle hadn't done much before. I think this is his first feature film, if not one of his first jobs. And he just brings a certain freshness to it. There's none of that acting required. Really.
Yeah, he reminded me of the little lad in Kez.
Yeah. David Bradley.
Yeah.
He's a fantastic little actor and, you know, just a joy to be with. I had a great time being with him.
It feels that there was some good scripting as well, which probably attracted you to the part in the first place. But yeah. Did you manage to play with it? Did you manage to improvise with him? Did you have to improvise with Kyle because it was his first time?
No, I sadly have got some memory problems, so I have to improvise anyway, regardless of the fact that I just can't remember any of the lines.
It is actually about sort of handing on fatherhood, because you come on and I thought, well, he's dad, he's boy, and then the film takes a sort of another sort of veer into another direction.
Yeah,
and it becomes clear that it's about sort of, you know, handing on misery to dad.
There's a few scenes where with me and my son, who's Kyle Ward, at the gravestone, at the graveyard with my father, who's dead. So there's a whole kind of attempt to tie up the sort of generational inheritance or whatever. The fact that I didn't have a great father figure, and I wasn't around for my son, and he's had no kind of father figure. He's had no kind of that learning process of just by osmosis learning how your fathers did. It was not present in his life, because I'd left the relationship when he was about 3 years old. And it's the first time I've seen this kid for 10 years. All of a sudden, there he is, 13, 14 years old. He's got a baby. Everything about, you know, I don't know anything about this kid, really. If effectively I could be a complete stranger, but there's still that emotional and biological tie. And I don't know how to be a father. I'd never learned that from my dad, the character, and I didn't pass on any of that lack of learning to my own son. I absconded. And yet in the story, in the narrative of the film, Kyle goes on this journey with his little baby son and discovers how to become a father, discovers what responsibility is, discovers how this bond can't be broken. Mm. it teaches me effectively, retrospectively, what it was, what my responsibilities should have been.
And are you a good father yourself?
I think that
in normal life,
me,
yeah,
I don't know. You have to ask the kids. I occasionally shout too much. Apparently, I've just got a very deep voice. It's not. It's all.
You're
training.
Actually.
Yeah. I'm an actor, darling.
This film, which was sort of set in North Wales, isn't it?
Yeah, mainly North Wales.
But
you've
come over from Liverpool.
Which was
handy.
Yeah. Very handy. Now they built a tunnel.
and it was handy. It reminded me, obviously, of a film that you did with Stephen Frears, Liam.
Oh yeah, yeah.
In which you were the sort of dad. You would have, I mean, another. You were working with a son in that film as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, as soon as I saw this, I thought, oh, it kind of harks back to that Stephen Frears work. And obviously, Stephen Frears, as that was one of his sort of his minor kind of works, but it stayed with me as one of his finest.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the nature of it is, it's very small. It doesn't have a large cinematic visual landscape. It was made, I mean, you know, and he does alternate. He does alternate in his career between sort of slightly bigger things and smaller things. But the nature of the beast is it's trying to get people to come and see something like Liam on a cinema outside of Italy, where you know, or wherever. You know what I mean? In the rest of Europe, people will go and see that. In England, we tend not to. We need to have a little bit of bells and whistles on something to make people leave the house.
Well, that's right. I mean, I bring it up because here you are again in A Boy Called Dad, working in a very minor kind of British film in terms of small independent film. It seems to me you're one of those people that would only do a job if the script was right or the character was right. I don't know if I'm giving you some really strong artistic integrity.
You try your best to do only work that you think is valuable. And then when you've been out of work for 9 months, you take any other job. And that's the nature of anybody in any business. You just try and hold out as long as you can for good work, for work that you believe in, for work that you find, you know, offers you something, you know, emotionally and whatever else. But if that doesn't happen, then you go to work like anybody else would do. You know what I mean? Still got to pay the mortgage.
Yeah.
But
you seem to have been quite lucky. I don't know if you've been on the edge of it and then just suddenly something right does come along.
No, my capacity to hold out is quite big. You know what I mean? Years can go by, because all they do is sit on the couch, and a year can go by quite easily with me, you know? Oh, really? I haven't worked? Oh, bugger. All right, then.
What do you do in that situation as an actor? Do you get onto your agent? Do you get scripts? I mean, because you have a power. It seems to me something like A Boy Called Dad, you have the power, Ian, because you're sort of one of those actors that if you're attached to a project, people might go, oh, I'll make that.
I don't know if that's necessarily the case any longer, but it possibly was once upon a time. I mean, certain directors and certain writers and certain producers kind of, want for a better word, dig what I do. Mm. And others, I would imagine, like the Clash of the Titans people, would take one look at me and go, nah, you're not really, it's not what we want.
Yeah.
But it's not really, but you know what I mean? You don't fit into this milieu. You don't fit into this kind of film. You'd just be taking it in a completely different direction.
You'd be rubbish in a skirt anyway.
I wouldn't. I've got great legs, actually.
Oh, right.
One of my best features. And it also hides the belly of skirt, I find.
Yeah. We've seen your legs in football movies in which you're...
Yeah,
which
get your legs out occasionally, yeah.
And knobbly knees.
I've got knobbly knees, yeah. Especially, I specialise in late 60s, early 70s football players.
Yeah. I mean, that rings up when you were talking about going to see Bolton Brothers comedies. And I just wonder whether young Ian Hart got the acting bug. Was it watching... it seems to me that you're almost a man out of time sometimes. You're always cast as you know in the 60s, in the 70s. I mean, I don't know if...
I've got an old face.
Yeah.
No, the things that got me going or interested in being an actor were that sinking feeling. It was the first time... Or Kez, for that matter, you know what I mean? Seeing people who were not Paul Newman in a film. I mean, because prior to that, I'd watched Westerns and, you know... Some of us can remember back when in the days when television wasn't on 24 hours a day, and when a film was on, you watched it regardless of what the film was, whether it be a musical with Doris Day or a John Wayne Western, you watched them all because there was nothing else, to watch.
But you must have thought, well, I'll never get in one of those.
I'll never be in one of them. You know what I mean? I'm never going to be Paul Newman. I'm never going to be like that or whatever. So until I think it was my 14 when I'd seen Kez on TV, but I went to the cinema and went to see. Maybe Gregory's Girl, or that sinking feeling, and just saw normal people being in a film and telling a story and being engaged and entertained by it. I thought, wow, that's weird. Didn't know they made those kind of films. I mean, again, if you go back to British films of the 50s and 60s, it was, hello, how are you?
Anyone for tennis?
What ho? And again, I'd grown up in Liverpool, didn't think, oh, I could play what ho. I actually could play what ho.
Yeah, you'd be rather good.
But however, I didn't think that was a possibility. It wasn't until I saw those films that I kind of twigged the idea that it might be feasible.
And then you went to drama school? And...
I didn't get into drama school because I'm not very good at auditioning to this day. And I think there's a different process involved. I'm hoping so anyway. That's my excuse. It always has been. I'm sticking with it. I auditioned for every drama school. Lambda, RADA, Guildhall, Central, Bristol, everyone. Which cost me a fortune. I was unemployed.
In train fares and bus
fares. I used to hitchhike. But it was 15 quid a go every time you auditioned. Just for the application fee. And I didn't get in to any of them. Because I was dreadful, really. I didn't understand what it was they were asking of me, I suppose. But no, when I didn't get into drama school, I went to work on a farm and try and do something else with my life. And then lost that job. We won't go into the entire history of my life, but, you know. Farming was it for me, really. That was where it was going to be. I like playing with the animals and getting up early.
Yeah, so what pulled you out?
My brother, really. My brother turned up at the farm and I lost my job. But that's besides the point. There's a whole history of those stories. And they all start with my brother.
Right, well, we have to do a special Ian Hart podcast. They could be...
Everything was going fine until...
Ian Hart, thank you so much for coming
in. Thank you.
See you, and lovely to see you. And
cheers.
I hope... I don't know when we'll see you next. When are we going to see you next?
I don't know. I'll have to do another film.
Oh, right. Get off the sofa.
Yeah.
Cheers, Ian.
Cheers.
My thanks to Ian Hart. And A Boy Called Dad is on UK wide release from Friday the 30th of April. From A Boy Called Dad to a critic called Peter. Peter Bradshaw joins me this week to review some of this week's other release.
What an outstanding link. That's your best ever.
Thank you. Been working on that for weeks. Yeah. Been planning your visit, Peter Bradshaw. Very nice to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
This week we'll be looking at the second installment of Iron Man. They've called it Iron Man 2, an Austrian revenge film called Revanche, and a British thriller called The Disappearance of Alice Creed. But we'll start with Iron Man 2, which finds Robert Downey back in the suit, aided by Pepper Potts, played by Gwyneth Paltrow, this time taking on Mickey Rourke, plus a villain perhaps on the inside in Scarlett Johansson.
You come from a family of thieves and butchers, and now like all guilty men, try to rewrite your own history. And you forget all the lives the Stark family has destroyed.
Speaking of thieves, where did you get this design?
My father, Anton Vanko.
I never heard of him.
My father is the reason you're alive.
The reason I'm alive is because you had a shot, you took it, you missed.
Did I?
It was Mickey Rourke there, wrestling with a Russian accent. Peter, yes. Did you like the first Iron Man?
I was agnostic about the first Iron Man. I mean, it's very well made. It looks great. I was a bit unsold on it. But I have to say, I'm coming around to it, and I am developing my hetero crush on Robert Downey Jr. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Who would have guessed? But somehow the Iron Man Stark role, he's just born to do it. And he just looks so kind of, he looks like he is enjoying himself as he's never enjoyed himself before. And it's absolutely, he does look good. He looks great. It's as if it's his great role.
Do you remember he was in a film called The Soloist that Joe Wright made? Well, yeah. I went to visit him on the set making that Robert Downey Jr. And he just sort of made Iron Man. And he was with Catherine Keener, his indie film kind of buddies. And they were teasing and she went, well, after Iron Man, it's all going to be. And he was like, oh, don't. And I said, what? And he said, oh, I've just done this film, Iron Man. It's a bit stupid. I don't know what's going to happen. And this was sort of 6 months before it came out. And obviously, suddenly, it was an enormous hit. It's kind of revived him.
It's revived him. It's made him a player. It's given him that much yearned for quality in Hollywood clout. And you could see he's always buzzing. He's always got that sort of mad caffeine buzz going through him. But now he's got 1,000 volts as well. He really is glowing,
and
with
it starts,
how well it's doing, and how good he is in the role.
Even in this role, it starts with him as a kind of rock star. This Tony Stark that he plays is kind of this gig. It's like Hello Wembley kind of stuff.
And he carries it off as nobody else could carry it off, with exactly the right irony, absurdity, the twinkle in the eye, the realization that, wow, you know, you're not supposed to take it too seriously, and yet I am kind of fabulous. And Robert Downey Jr. has exactly the right patina of irony and fun to make it work. I can't imagine anybody else doing it now. And I don't know. I'm still not totally sold on Iron Man, to be honest with you, but he's great.
He's great. Now I'm with you on that. I love all the stuff with him. He sort of manages to bring a bit of screwball to the superhero genre, as if Cary Grant was doing
that kind of nervy, talky thing he always does. There's a great scene at the beginning, the Senate hearing scene, which is a terrific scene, which he kind of carries off exactly with exactly the amount of chutzpah and all the rest of it. The rest of it, again, it looks good. I think it's a long, long film, though, at over 2 hours, and I'd sort of tuned out a good 20 minutes before the final whistle.
I'm kind of with you there. They always end up developing into these films, whether they're Iron Man or the Transformers or whatever, into robots having a fight at the end of it, and that must happen. It's an inexorable kind of
the
logic.
Great
of
the clang of metal on metal. It's all a bit of a mess, but it's an entertaining mess, and it sells it every cent of it.
Yeah, I just thought there was no real sense of fun or threat. As you say, I did tune out. Everything was lively and witty and funny, I was just a bit bored by the end. If I was a kid and this was my toy, I might just leave it in the box and go and do something else better instead.
I felt that, but I didn't feel that all the way through, and I kind of only felt that towards the final 20 minutes.
Yeah, but Scarlett Johansson's in a cat suit, Peter. I should be just... Ah.
Yeah, we should be kind of... Our tongues should be on the floor. And they kind of are on the floor. Yeah, and she'd obviously been trained in making it look good and sort of whacking people and then stopping on one knee with one of your arms out straight in an absurd angle, which is apparently the way
you have to
do it. She
never did that for Woody Allen.
No, exactly. Or for Sofia Coppola, come to think of it.
Let's move on to something rather different, Peter. I love the fact that we can do this in world cinema. We can jump from Iron Man to...
The kings of Segway here.
I don't have a link that is as good as my critic called Peter.
Don't blame me.
To Götz Spielmann's Revanche, which is an Austrian film set in the outskirts of Vienna, inside Vienna, in the seedy bits of Vienna, and then in the countryside of Vienna, as a man befriends his prostitute girlfriend and then does a bank robbery.
Another bank.
Was heißt das? Ich mach Bank.
Geh rein, zeig ihnen die Pistole. Wie scheiße sie an vor Angst, ich nehme mir das Geld und geh wieder raus.
Blödsinn.
Das war ein Bank robbery in German.
Genau, as they say, I don't know what they say, in Tief Österreich, it's set partly in Wien, it's set partly in this very, very Tief Österreich countryside. It's got a French title, which slightly baffled me because this is very, very, very Austrian.
Isn't it?
With some first-class Austrian kind of slanguage dialect, which I found utterly impenetrable.
Really? I enjoy listening to that, though.
Yes, it's...
I've always loved listening to German.
It's very weird. It's very weird. It cuts back and forth between the kind of bürgerlich, kind of more approachable German and some very, very kind of... country kind of down home.
Yeah, a nuance.
Kind of hillbilly, basically. Hillbilly.
A nuance.
Hillbilly Austria.
Which will be, I mean, bright as many reviewers are, that nuance will be lost on some of them.
It looks fantastic. It's got this absolutely glittering diamond cinematography from a guy called Martin Geschlacht. Brilliantly named. It's very, very contrived and implausible from the word go, to be honest with you. Its success is that it kind of persuades you that it isn't, but the idea, the fundamental idea that a pretty unprepossessing Robert Carlyle-ish looking...
Doesn't he look like Robert Carlyle? Yes. He's had a few more, too many platypus.
Yes, he doesn't look particularly sexy. The idea that this barman would have this passionate and sexual affair with a downtrodden Ukrainian prostitute is fundamentally implausible. I suggest that indicates a really basic failure to understand exactly what life is like for these girls. But anyway, there we are. That's implausible from the word go. And the denouement is, as I say, interesting, unviolent, unexpectedly unviolent and redemptive denouement is, I think, contrived as well.
However, I found it frustrating and anticlimactic.
Yeah. However, it looks absolutely superb. I mean, it's beautifully composed. I mean, it's, as I say, it's got that sort of degree zero kind of composition.
It's got that real flair. It's almost, we talked about Haneke influencing Jessica Hausner's Lourdes a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
There's clearly a sort of school of, it's Christian Berger who does it for Haneke, that kind of brilliant cinematography.
Absolutely,
but this one is
razor sharp, beautifully framed and composed. Especially the kind of exterior shots,
and that has a sort of dramatic kind of impact. It kept me watching
because it's like a kind of ca- caffeine jolt because it just looks so, so exquisite.
This is Revanche by Götz Spielmann aus Österreich. Peter, we're going to go to a British thriller now, The Disappearance of Alice Creed, directed by the first-timer Jay Blakeson. We're going to talk more about the film with Eddie Marson shortly, so we're going to go straight into it, Peter, which I think is probably apt for this film, which goes straight into it itself.
It goes straight. I've got to say, I thoroughly enjoyed this. I had no expectations of it whatsoever. I really didn't know anything about Jay Blakeson. Apparently he's made a couple of short films, and he's been obviously working on this, revising it, honing it, working on his script. I thought it was terrifically enjoyable. It's melodramatic. Each one of the twists is accompanied by this extraordinary kind of popping firework display of acting, which has to carry you across each twist. But I have to say, it's socked over with extraordinary elan and energy by a terrific cast. Eddie Marson, absolutely great. Martin Compson, maybe not quite as great, but still good. And Gemma Arterton, who I'm sorry and ashamed to admit I've done my share of patronising Gemma Arterton, but she was very, very good recently on a TV version of Tess of the D'Urbervilles, and she's good in this.
Yeah, she's good in this, and apparently very good in Stephen Frears' the Posey Simmons film.
Well, I'm looking forward to that.
You can, we'll see
that. I'm looking forward to that. I don't want to get you, there are so many spoilers and so many twists, I don't want to give it away.
There's a little message from Jay Blakeson in the press notes saying, please, I mean, I know, I don't want to tell you what to do, but don't avoid some spoilers. And there are, but it is a three-hander. I mean, it literally, there is no one else in it.
It looks like it maybe could be a stage play. Who knows, maybe he thought of it as a stage play, but actually it's very cinematic.
I think it
suddenly jolts,
right?
Opens out to a few exterior locations towards the end, very, very nicely. What can I say? It's got a great opening sequence where the two criminals wordlessly and with military precision prepare their nasty little flat as a kind of military holding cell for their hostage. And it absolutely had me gripped.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And they go to a DIY store, they do the van, they cut it out. I mean, you're not quite sure what they're preparing for. It looks like the worst kind of slaughter. It could be there. There's a threat of menace, actually.
There is real menace and something kind of fascinatingly kind of cold and grim about it. It's terrifically enjoyable, I think. Good luck to Jay Blakeson.
I think it might do quite well. I mean, the people are talking about a cult classic in some kind of way, but I think it might actually be an instant classic. I mean, as a British thriller go, I would watch this. It reminded me also something of some of those. There was a US kind of trend for something like Best Laid Plans a few years ago. So there's indie films, and it had that kind of class to it.
Yes.
I didn't for a moment think, oh, this is a sort of bit of a sub British thriller. It's not going to get there. I thought this was a movie that I would go and watch on a Friday night and say, wow, that was bloody good.
Yeah.
Peter, lovely to see you. Thank you very much
for
stepping into The Breach brilliantly again this week. Lovely to see you. Thanks to Peter Bradshaw. To read all of Peter's reviews, just go to guardian.co.uk/film.
You're going to look into this camera and speak to your father. Tell him that he must pay the money. He must do exactly as we ask, or we will kill you. And you tell him that you have no doubt that we will kill you. Understand? Take one.
Daddy, I'm okay. They just took me. I was leaving the house and they just took me. I don't know where I am.
Stop. I don't want a narrative. I just want you to look into the camera and tell him that unless he pays the money, we will kill you. Any deviation from our instructions, we will kill you. Any police, we will kill you. Understand?
Yes.
No.
Eddie Marson there in a scene from The Disappearance of Alice Creed where he plays the ruthless Vic, a man with a plan to extract a ransom for the return of Alice Creed. But a simple plan that starts to unwind. And to help me unwind the film without letting any spoilers out of the swag bag is Eddie Marson, who joins me in the studio. Welcome to Film Weekly again, Eddie.
Thank you very much.
Always
Jason.
Lovely to have you here, especially
nice
when you've
you.
Got when you've got a fantastic thriller. Peter Bradshaw and I were just talking about it. This is top notch, kind of chiseled. It knows where it's going, this thriller. And that's what's so great about The Disappearance of Alice Creed is that you know where it's going as an actor, but we as an audience really we trying to guess it, but you're always second guessing it. And is that the trick as an actor when you're in one of these things is to kind of play it, because you've obviously read the script, you know where it's going. How do you sort of play it as if we don't know where it's going?
Well, it's basically in the writing. It's not in the acting is the discipline of the acting is serving the writing. So if the writer's structured it in a certain way, you just have to hit those points. It's like being a saxophone player in a big band, really. You know exactly when to come in and when to hold back. That's what it's all about. You've got to get out of the way, really.
Because it seemed to me that this one is written and directed by Jay Blakeson. And I'm not going to talk much more about him unless he tells me the rest of the letters in his name. Good old Jay. He probably wants a lot more money for his next film because this is going to do quite well, I would suggest. But in a way, he obviously works very well because the shots were very well planned. At no point did I think, I wish this opened out a bit more. I wish there was a bit more flashy cinematography at all. It is what it is. It's got no extra fat on it.
No, exactly. Yeah, and that's what appealed to me when I did it. I don't know there's a kind of different discipline for making big budget movies. I'm sure that Jay will have that discipline, but I hope he makes another movie like this, to be honest with you, because I think there's more room for this. I think this is the kind of movie that the British film industry should make, really.
Yeah, I was saying to Peter that this is the sort of film I would happily go and see on a Friday night. I mean, there's only three people in it and there's no big, you know, effects in it. There's no Iron Man coming in to kind of blow the place up.
Yeah.
But I would not feel dissatisfied having seen this. This is a full meal of a film.
It's an epic. It's an epic, even though it's a fixed location and a small cast. It's still an epic film. And that's because of his writing and his directing.
Yeah, nice performances as well, obviously. They're sort of very three different characters as well, which made... But did you have to sort of say, well, I'll play it like this, and you talked to Martin Compton about how he was going to play it? Is there much planning, or did you just turn up with the character in mind? And then I'm sort of maybe talking about the rehearsal periods, because I know you don't get that long. If this was a stage play, which it could be, you'd obviously rehearse quite a lot.
Yeah, this was... We had a week's rehearsal.
A
and we
week?
Worked, yeah, and we worked out the relationship between me and Martin. But because we were both had served in prison together, Vic and Danny. So we built up that relationship and all the dynamics of those two. And then because I've done Mike Lee...
Yeah, I was just going to say, did you sort of say, now listen, mate, I know you've done Ken Loach. That's nothing, Sweet 16. I've done Mike Lee. I've spent 15 years doing it and got on screen for half an hour. I know how to do this sort of stuff. And he was quite happy to listen to that.
No, what I do is, because I've done Mike Lee, is I like to be I like to keep the ignorance of the character.
Yeah.
So if he was going to talk to Gemma about anything, I would go out the room. Because I've got to be kept in ignorance of my character.
Wow. So that's a Vera Drake technique.
That's a very Vera Drake technique.
I mean, I thought back to Vera Drake when I was watching you in this. Not because the characters are similar, but there is a surprise there are a couple of surprises in this film, which we're not going to talk about, like there is in Vera Drake. Like and that famously, you know, Mike Lee hadn't told any of you in the cast what she did. And that shot came through. And you still use that technique.
I still, yeah. And even now when I'm being directed by, working with directors and actors, and if a director wants to talk about, say me and you're doing a scene and a director says, Jason, I think you think this about Eddie, I'll go out the room. I say, I don't want to know what he thinks about me. I know what I think he thinks about me, but I don't want to know what he thinks about me. It's none of my business.
Do you think you could do that? I mean, say you've worked with Martin Scorsese as well on Gangs of New York. You could, if Leonardo DiCaprio was doing that, could you sort of say, right, I'm off the set here,
I just walk away. I walk to the other side of the room. Because they're so busy giving notes to that actor. I don't want to know the notes the other actor's getting. It's not my business.
That's brilliant. And are other actors like that? Or is that something that you learned worked for you when you were working with Mike Lee?
I learned from Mike Lee. He sends you out the room. Actually, he sends you to the other side of London sometimes.
You're not in Penge.
Yeah.
It is it's sort of character actors week here on film. And I mean, I think you are one of my finest. We had Ian Hart on slightly earlier as well. Being a character actor, though, is a sort of absolute skill. And you seem to have kind of, you know, you're the guy. And I love seeing the fact that so many people are finding you different characters to play and different sort of looks that you're managing to come up with, from, you know, from a Dickensian guy to a sort of a modern kind of gangster to even working for Malick and Scorsese. It's sort of working for you, Eddie, but you always knew that you had to be a character actor, I assume.
Yeah, character actors are the kind of guys at drama school, we play the old men in the Chekhov plays.
But when you're 20.
Yeah, and the leading men kiss the girls and shoot themselves at the end. And we just drink vodka all the time. So I think a character actor like Ian Hart, for instance, when I first started into films, I was actually, I had two lines in a film that Ian had a big part in, which was Bee Monkey. And he was very supportive to me. He's always been very nice to me. And I think I follow the example of people like Ian and Gary Oldman as well, which is where you look at it and you think, if I can't be the leading man, I've got to be diverse. Mm. I've got to be able to earn a living by disappearing into different parts. Nobody goes to see an Eddie Marsden film. They go to see a film that I disappear into. And that's what I enjoy, really.
We go to Eddie Marsden films. What are you talking about? Film Weekly listeners, they love an Eddie Marsden film. I mean, I think you're sort of getting there as a a character actor. But is it difficult? Do you wish? I mean, what can you do about it? You can't say, well, I'm handsome, tall, and strong. I'm going to be a leading man. But you have to kind of give of yourself each time without disappearing and people going, well, I don't recognise you, because that started at the beginning of your career. You do so much character work and makeup and beards and all that. People don't remember what you look like.
Yeah, I mean, it works in a sense. What it does is I hope that it guarantees longevity of a career. What it doesn't do is it doesn't give you a very stark trajectory. You know, you don't become the next big thing. A lot of my career at the moment is coming and doing a few scenes with the next big thing. And every other film is this kid's the next big thing, you know. And they're nice kids, you know. What I was lucky enough is I learned to act in anonymity. I learned to act when nobody could see me. You know, my mum came to Fringe Place and that was it. And a lot of these young kids, they're learning to act in front of millions and millions of people. Yeah. And if they make a mistake, they're hounded for it, you know. And I think, so in a sense, it's a blessing and a curse being a character actor. But if the film's good, I get praised. If it's bad, no one blames me.
We're getting a real peek inside, having you and Ian Hart on the same show. You're getting a real peek inside the actual life of an actor. There's so many stars, as you mentioned, them sort of live in a different atmosphere to it. Yeah. But the reality check is brilliant. I mean, I think your character in Alex Creed is on the page, it could be just sort of almost one note, but you bring so much complexity to this character of Vic. Do we love him? Do we hate him? Are we scared of him? Do we care for him? Do we want to cuddle him? Do we want to mollycoddle him? Do we want to kind of, you know, make him go nowhere near us? He's a kind of creepy guy, but he's also got so much depth to him.
I used to have a great Russian drama teacher who knew that I was going to play villains, and he said to me, Eddie, there's no such thing as evil people, there's just unhappy people in search of happiness. And that's what I always think. I never play villains, I always play people. And then that's why people say, oh, that was a good villain, because it wasn't, it was a real person. If you met Fred West, he'd be terrifying, but there'd be something about him was uncomfortable, because part of you would start to sympathise with him or start to understand what must have caused this man to do that. And that's what's good drama.
You scared me in Little Dorrit as well. That was a wonderful character as well, wasn't he?
Yeah. We based him on the bull terrier in Oliver.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So you were the human incarnation Oliver Reed's dog. Are you a person who kind of sees animals in the people and has to kind of, like, you know, that Lecoq Gollier school of acting, which kind of always asks for, like, I see this man as a bird or this person as a cat. Is that something you do?
I try and find an essence. I try and find something about them that is like a point of reference to always go to. I mean, when we were doing Panks, Dickens wrote him as being a man with thick black hair. And I had very short at the time, and they was going to have to wig me. And then I found out they were doing high definition. And my wife's a makeup artist, and she said wigs on high definition would look terrible. So I said, well, why don't you shave my head, give me a scar, and I'll look like Bullseye. And we did it then, and it worked, you know. So it was kind of, it was a combination of fear of looking like a prat, basically, and also thinking it would actually work for the character.
So do you do this a lot at home? Is that what it's like at the Marstons?
My wife is very good. My wife did Lord of the Rings, and she did Nine and the Golden Compass. She's a very accomplished makeup artist. So she's very good at helping me to understand what I can utilise. That's one of the reasons why I disappear. Is my wife says, we can do that. If you do this, that changes. And I do that a lot.
Brilliant. So is there a lot of bits of you always like lying around the bedroom floor, like an ear?
When I first met my wife, she made me up as a pig. And she had to do a big cast of my face. And it was all over her house. And then when first time I met her dad, she hadn't told him that I was going out with her. And he looked at me and said, I know you from somewhere. And I've been all over his house for 6 months.
As a pig.
Like a cast of my face.
And you fell in love. It was love at first sight.
She fell in love with the pig. She fell in love with the pig.
You married the artist.
Yeah.
It's tremendous to see you. It's not a lead role in Alice Creed, because you all share that burden as well. But the three of you in a really fine British film, I think, that I hope will have some longevity, as you will to your career. Eddie Marston, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you.
The Disappearance of Alice Creed, which we thoroughly recommend here on Film Weekly, is on release from Friday the 30th of April across the UK. And that is all for this week. A huge thanks to my brilliant character acting guests, Eddie Marston and Ian Hart. The music you've been hearing in this week's podcast is from The Disappearance of Alice Creed. It's by Mark Canham, and pulsating stuff it is too. Don't forget to pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday for my Trailer Trash column. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.